Hello, it's Peter Wright and Kathleen Beauvais with another episode of the Yakking Show, the Harmony Your Path to Wholeness channel. And this is the channel where we bring you interesting and experienced guests who give you tips and ideas to lead a better, healthier, and hopefully longer life. But first, let's introduce co-host Kathleen. Hi, Kathleen. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Peter. Thank you so much. And thank you also very much for tuning into our show. We so appreciate having you. And I am so super excited to have this guest on today. He is DJ Kadagian. Welcome to the show, DJ. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for having me.
Good.
Now, DJ is an award-winning documentary filmmaker and best-selling author. He has been featured at over 120 film festivals around the world. His innovative and thought-provoking works have focused on socioeconomic issues, race relations, religion and spirituality, alternative healing, and poetry. But today, he's here to yak with us about near-death experiences and psychedelic psychotherapy. So let's just jump right in. So, DJ, you've researched near-death experiences from the time of Plato. However, many skeptics would argue that these are merely figments of a vivid imagination or even stress. How do you counter that argument?
I totally understand why they're it's kind of a fantastical subject, and I was extremely skeptical when I first came across it, which was about 25, 30 years ago. I was kind of studying different religions, and particularly when I got into Hinduism and Buddhism. I mean, Buddhism is more of a practice than a religion. But it really got into more of, I was very interested in the dying part of it, and more dying ego death kind of thing. But then the deeper you get into it, particularly in Buddhism, with the Tibetan Book of the Dead and these types of things, then you kind of go into a whole nother realm. And during all my research, I ran across a book by Raymond Moody, who really kind of popularized the near-death experience. I mean, it really wasn't known at all prior to him. And when I first started reading about it, it seemed to me to be a little too, I don't want to say too good to be true, but it just sounded, I had a hard time believing it. So I understand where a skeptic come from, certainly. And back in the day, there just wasn't a lot of research. And I come from a background in finance and quantum economics. So I write trading programs, software programs for trading the markets, all different markets. So I'm a massive number cruncher, and there really wasn't a lot of research back then. So had I had research, it would have been, I probably would have written this book 20 some odd years ago. But in terms of someone who's a skeptic, I was definitely there, and it's kind of, I'm a professional skeptic because I really need to see proof in numbers. Statistical significance is kind of a term you talk about. And what happened was that I had actually, my son passed away about 4 years ago. And after he passed, my wife gave me this workbook to look at. And because I was wiped out, I mean, I was pretty much whole, wiped out in bed for I can't even tell you how long. And she gave me this workbook, and it's kind of a workbook that I kind of it kind of looks corny, and you fill it in as you go. And but I was just so, at that point, I hadn't really done anything for a while, so I started looking through it. And one of the things that was in there that really caught my attention, I have this reincarnation, past life, regression, so these kinds of things. But when I saw the near-death experience, it kind of pointed me to some YouTube videos where people were giving testimonials. And so I watched a few of those. And these didn't exist 25 years ago. You just couldn't really watch them. And there was a handful of books, so there wasn't a lot out there. But when I started watching these, what struck me as, the most, I was struck by how, you could tell these people were not making these stories up. Now, whether they were true or not, can be debated. But there was no question these people were telling a truth that they believe they experienced. And I watched a lot of these, and that really caught my attention. And I said, okay, well, let me research a little bit deeper. And if and there've been a number of there's a group called NDERF, Near Death Experience Research Foundation. They're really the best, and they have about 5 or 6,000 testimonials that they've recorded.
Wow.
People go into their website, fill out an incredibly comprehensive questionnaire that's really responsibly put together. And they've been gathering these now for over 20 years. And I literally read through thousands of these. And the more that I read through those, and the more that I watched these testimonials and read books, the more that it was very hard for me to punch holes in it, especially as a quantum economist, because the numbers, the statistics, and some of these have been now reported in some of the best peer-reviewed journals, like The Lancet. So this is like very, it's pretty serious at this point. So from a research standpoint, and just to, the authenticity that I saw in these people that were giving their testimonials, I was convinced. And I think, to convince a skeptic, I mean, I could give you, and I will give you some reasons, some specific practical kind of experiences that I saw that would probably lend some credence to this. And then beyond that, I would say you really have to watch some of these people that are giving testimonials. And if you go to, I have a website that's specifically geared to the near-death experience. I think it's probably the it's a very comprehensive website. It connects you to not just these research written research reports, but also some of the testimonials that to me were the most profound and moving and believable. And so I would point someone there and say, look, if you really do want to know a little bit more about it, beyond what I might say, I think that website that links to these testimonials, as well as obviously the research I have in the book, I think is a really good place to start. But I do have a couple of things if you want to hear how I would probably talk to somebody that really doesn't, says, how is it possible?
Yes, I'd love to hear.
Yeah, keep going. Let's hear it.
There's two things I think that come up. They're very, very different ends of, spectrum. But the first I'll start out with is I like to talk about this because it's very uncomfortable for people that have even had a near-death experience. It's and because they it's a lot of times, and what I write about in my book is that it's the things that you don't hear in these testimonials, or that they don't describe seeing, that to me have the most impact. And in this one in particular, because it's somewhat disturbing, that it really isn't brought up in the thousands of testimonials that I've read and watched. And that's the fact that when these people have this experience and they cross over, they visit people, they see people. And one of the more interesting things is that they never see people that are alive, which is radically different from dreams. And it's radically different from, for example, if you experience ayahuasca, which is derived from DMT. DMT is a chemical that we all have in our brain, and during death, they say, okay, that it's released, and that's what people are experiencing. But I've done worked with enough DMT with shaman in the Amazon and in the Sacred Valley, low dose, very high dose, and I can tell you that it's very, very different than near-death experience. There are some things that you could say cross over, and with dreams as well, but for the most part, they're very, very different. But one of the things that I found interesting is, okay, you're meeting all these people. Now, first of all, none of them have passed away. None of them are living. Once in a while, you'll hear, I saw somebody that they thought were living, but then realized or found out later that they had already passed away. Now, in dreams, at least probably the majority of the people that you're encountering in your dreams are alive. And the same thing in an ayahuasca experience with DMT. I would say that the majority, the vast majority, are alive, which is completely different than near-death experience. But one of the people that you tend to meet relatives, you might meet a parent, you might meet friends you grew up with. The one person you don't meet ever, I mean, there might be you might see this as a major outlier, very, very rare, that you'll meet your spouse. And I always found that like really, really interesting. Because the first person I would want to meet, I would hope to meet if they predeceased me, would be my spouse. I would want to see my wife. And I would think that so many people, that's what they would want. And when you consider that the age of people that have near-death experience, they tend to be older, they tend to have been married, and many of them have had a spouse predecease them. So, but they never see them. But they'll see an aunt, they'll see a brother, they'll see a sister. And one of the reasons I think that's significant is that's not something I would think would be pleasant or encouraging. Well, I'm going to get over there and I never saw this person. And that's the person I want to see more than anybody. That's the person I should be seeing. So when I I also find it interesting because when you listen to people give their testimonials or you watch some of these conferences where there's hundreds of people in these groups that have most of them have had them, they never bring it up. And I understand it's somewhat uncomfortable. And maybe because what we don't see in these things, we just don't discuss in the near-death experience. But to me, that's major. That's very, very significant. Statistically, massively significant if you're looking at it from, crunching numbers, that would be one of the main things you would expect to see. So by what you don't see and what's not really comfortable to me reaffirms, makes it more likely, in my opinion, that it's real from the standpoint of people are not making these things up. And they're not saying things that are uncomfortable, but they're not trying to project things that didn't actually happen. And so that's me. I know it sounds strange, but that's me. Well, I was looking at in a lot of cases, what don't people see? What are we not hearing that's happening in there that leads me to believe more that it is true or it's not true. We'd love to see, hey, I saw my dog, my pets, and so on. That's another thing. Very, very, very rare that you would see a pet. And again, that's another thing. I lost my dog Spot, and I haven't seen him, and I can't wait to play with him when I get up there. You almost never see that. Very, very, very rare. Why is that? So these are the two things that I would think would be the first thing people would want to say. Yeah, I was up there with my wife, and my dog was there, and so on and so forth. It just literally doesn't happen. And that's very different from dreams. It's very different from, say, an ayahuasca experience. So that's my first thing. To me, it was really important. It may not mean as much to other people, or it might be, well, but if you really think about it, I think it's very, very, very significant. And
I
to me,
think it's actually a little upsetting to hear that.
yes. I believe there's a resolution to that. See, I think I believe that one what you do hear in there is that we travel in these groups throughout. We're not here just once. I mean, this is school. You come back and you have this family kind of that you're connected with, that you're having these experiences over and over and over. Our soul group, they kind of call them. So of course, your wife, the person you're connected to more than any, in my opinion, there's no question that that does occur. And what happens is always the people said it, are told it's not your time, you have to go back. Or they're told if you cross this boundary, which is often, a bridge or some kind of, in my opinion, it's a metaphor, but it means that you're crossing over now, you're going full over, you cannot come back. That's what they say. So it's what is it to me? What's on the other side of that? And there's also something that people describe very often when they almost describe it as a way station where these people are going. They're literally buildings and they're lined up or they're going somewhere else. So in my feeling is from everything I've seen is that you definitely will see that person, but it's not there.
Not
and it
there.
May be the significance of that person. I don't know what it is, but to me, that would be, from a statistical, you know, standpoint, based on how they describe these events and the fact that there's a boundary you cannot cross. These people are going somewhere completely different from where you are when you're experiencing it. And this is our sole group. So my feeling is, no question, you will eventually see them, but nobody mm-hmm. wrestles with that question. They never say, well, I never saw the person and what, you know, what. So I think it's very, very significant. And yes, it can be depressing in a way, but I do think that it resolves in a very positive way. But the fact that nobody sees them on first contact is significant. And I think that makes it more likely that these people are not, they're not making up their stories.
Sure.
What I find interesting, DJ, is that they actually see a person that they've known before. They can see them in their minds in the physical form.
Mm-hmm.
But upon death, we know that, well, I'm just saying that the soul leaves that body. You've left that body. That's just a vehicle.
Right.
Yeah. In a near-death experience, they actually see that person in their physical form.
Yes. Yeah, they do, and sometimes they don't, but they still recognize them. So I totally agree. I mean, you know, it's something called, you know, we hear, like when you leave the body, the out-of-body experience. And that's the other thing that I could talk about just a little bit, that to me sure. is very significant.
Okay.
But oftentimes these people that find themselves having crossed over, they will see themselves. They do see arms and legs, and they feel this body. But it's not uncommon at all that people don't actually feel a body. They have an awareness of themselves. They feel exactly, you know, the same consciousness. It's them. They don't just, you know, disperse into this ether. It's them. And they find great comfort in that because they're very much there and present, but they don't necessarily have a body. And to me, part of that is a lot of what I interpret this is that they're seeing things that help them to understand where they now are. And so they might be experiencing things as I would say as metaphor. Right. So a lot of the things like the bridge or the tunnel, they may not literally be that. They may, but it's the way people are experiencing it so that they can make sense of what's actually happening to them. When they see a loved one, oftentimes, I would say at least half the time, they will see this person at a younger age, an age they didn't even know, like a grandmother or what have you. The most common age is in the 30s. I don't know why, but that's what you'll hear described the most, and that they look, you know, radiant and this energy. But oftentimes they don't necessarily recognize them, but they know who they are without question. So yes, they will see a human figure. Sometimes they'll see glowing figures, but they always recognize who these people are.
Interesting.
Yeah, wow.
Which is really interesting. Sorry.
No, I was going to, I'm aware there's so much we could ask you and so much I want to hear, but we've got to be, recognize our time limitations. One of the things I wanted to ask you is in your book and on your website, you talk about the main events. You use that phrase a couple of times, main events during a near-death experience. What are those main events?
Well, I would say, I mean, right off the bat is the out-of-body experience, which I think is the most significant. In terms of, you know, trying to understand, is this for real? You know, and I think the out-of-body experience right off the bat, more than anything, to me is proof that these things are likely real. You have the tunnel experience, which is this transition, and the tunnel is described in different ways, the experience within it, moving through it. But there's always the same feeling that people have once they enter the tunnel, this feeling of unconditional love, this just feeling a warmth and a happiness, you know, instantly once they reach this place. It's not, you would think, well, I'm getting into this weird, you know, tunnel and I don't know where I am, and that they would be afraid and they're, you know, that they'd be uncomfortable. But that's not what they experience at all. It's always just an incredible feeling. You have something called the life review, which is where they, in a way you could say their life flashes before their eyes, but they'll see in almost a 360 degree vantage point, every event that happened in their life and all the people they affected. And they don't feel it just from their perspective. They feel what that person felt, you know, good or bad. And even though you think, well, you know, people would feel horrible for the bad things they do, and they'll reflect on it. They say there's never this, you're not made to feel bad or guilty or ashamed. It's all that this is a learning experience. There's a reason all of these things are happening. You will have many people experience, it's usually more of a city than a town or small buildings or a house here or there scattered. It's usually a large area, generally a city. They'll very often describe a place of learning, whether it's a library or not. They often enter there and people are, you know, reading. And it's very interesting. Now, a lot of them talk about what you would describe as maybe the Akashic Records, which is something you might see in a psychedelic experience where there's just these massive downloads of information where people say they understood everything. But as they were coming back, they could feel all of, you know, most of these things kind of slip away. So they don't forget what happened. They remember it 30 years on as if it had just happened 5 minutes ago. But very specific knowledge is kind of taken out as they come back. And it, you know, it might be just things that we may not, we shouldn't know while we're here, I guess, on this side. Right. Another event, as I mentioned, is coming to a border where you, you know, sometimes they'll give you the option of, you know, would you like to stay? But more often than not, they're said it's not their time. They have more that they have to do. And then they're sent back and they go oftentimes a sensation of really going backwards from the same way they came in very, very quickly. And then either immediately being over their body as they began the journey with the out-of-body experience, or just being pulled back into it. And they describe it uniformly as them not wanting to get back into their bodies, and in getting back in their bodies, just feeling horrible and cramped. And often they're in pain because, you know, the ones that are in my book are almost exclusively people that had cardiac arrest, because I really wanted to stick with people that were clinically dead in a hospital setting. So there was, you know, it's very, you know, you know, you have confirmation that this really happened, not just what they said, but where they were, what they were hooked up to, and that, you know, there was no brain activity, of no ability to form memories. You know, these things just can't happen in that setting. So that's how I looked. I would say those are kind of the main events. Yeah, most people don't have all of them. I mean, it's very rare that you would have all of them.
Right.
But, you know, but there are certain ones that tend to be more common than others.
I'll go to Kathleen.
I'm sorry.
Very quick one before I go back to you. Do any of people relating these experiences recall seeing God or angels or anything spiritual like that?
Actually, most often they do. They generally they refer to it as oftentimes a spiritual being. They almost always have somebody that is taking them through this place and explaining what's happening. When they have a life review, they never have that by themselves, which kind of makes sense because it's such a vast experience and so many questions that they have. They often talk about, and I'm not a religious person. I'm not, you know, Christian. I do believe I do believe that Jesus existed, but I'm not a religious person. I'm very interested in world religions. It's why my first films were about religion. So I'm saying this to preface this by when they do describe a person that's more than just a spiritual being, they very often say, "I know it was Jesus." And the strange thing is whether it was Hindu or Muslim or a Buddhist or whatever it was, but what they don't see this person as, and oftentimes they will see, they won't see God, but they'll experience God, this
Experience God.
massive energy that they just know is God. But what's really interesting is they never describe this person in religious terms. And what's really interesting is people that were very religious, they were very Christian. When they come back, they say they tend to, and again, these are in very, very large studies. They people that were very religious become less religious.
Less religious,
They become more spiritual, and those that didn't believe in anything become more spiritual. So there's this move to more spiritual and a realization that there's absolutely no difference. Religion just doesn't, it's not, it doesn't, there is no religion up there. Now, there might be an experience of, this person, but they often describe it as, this person looks like this. So you often hear these physical representations, more of say Jesus than God. But Jesus is not seen as a religious figure in any way.
But nobody that
And
they've actually physically would recognize, but they just happen to know who they are.
in terms of seeing him
Like
or
in when they see these spiritual beings, they see them as a physical form, not, but it doesn't resemble anybody that they would have encountered ever in their life. But they do, they happen to know who they are.
yes, they know that they're a spiritual being. They may be in physical form, or they may be like energy. But either way, they know that this is a very wise, old spiritual being, a very powerful being. So yeah, so I'm like I said, I'm not someone who, I'm not interested in organized religion. I've never really kind of, I did go to church for a while, and most of my life I did not. So I've been on both sides of that equation. What I'm really trying to be careful of is to put out, hey, this is for Christians only, and it's not like that. It's not like that at all. There's a whole chapter on religion in the book, and I think it's important to kind of look at it that way. Because then you'll see that this is nothing, and from everything I've read and heard, has nothing to do with organized religion or one
Organization.
right or religion is wrong. It's nothing
Oh,
like
good. Thank
that.
you for that.
In all of these near-death experiences, none of them have felt fear. Is that right?
Well, I would say that statistically, about somewhere between 1 and 2% do describe having a very scary experience.
Oh,
But
okay.
there's two things there. One is that that number is probably a little higher because people that have that experience are probably going to be less inclined to share that. So there's that part of it. The other part of it, though, on the positive side, is that the vast majority that do have one, those tend to resolve in a positive way. And when they have them, it's almost always very, very right at the beginning, and usually in this tunnel. It's not when they're in the hospital room looking at their bodies and the out of body experience. It's not further once they pass through the tunnel. It's almost always right before or right as they enter the tunnel, and then the vast majority of them resolve in a positive way. So, yeah, they do occur. Probably more than you hear, which is 1 to 2%. But the ones that we do hear about, most of them all resolve, which is good news. Yeah.
So let's delve into a little bit about reincarnation. Have you ever heard of the book Soul Survivor?
Yes, I have.
And it's about a young boy who claims to have been a pilot who was shot down during World War II. And I'd like for you to comment on past lives, because if anybody out there who has read the book, this young boy goes in tremendous detail and could even pick himself out in a photograph of these pilots from World War II, and he knew exactly to point, "That was me." And he was able to recount to some of this pilot's family members some things that nobody would have ever known. And he even knew where his plane went down in the sea. I mean, it's just mind-boggling. Just under, wow. Can you comment on
Well,
that?
I mean, yeah, you know, I didn't study reincarnation specifically. I felt like it was so clear from near-death experience that that is what is happening. So for me, it's like, yeah, of course. And I've heard enough of these stories similar to, yeah, I had heard about that story and actually read it, and I was pretty blown away by it because there's just no way. You know, and you see some of these people, that these kids that come out and they know these things, or you know, they can sit down at a piano at, you know, some age, like, you know, 4 years old, and just all of a sudden start playing like Chopin or something. And you know, you run into things where it's like, yeah, I mean, I've seen that in real time. I've read about it here on this plane. But when you look at the near-death experience, I mean, that's a theme that's constant. You know, this is school. And we keep coming, you know, coming back until we kind of get it. And this is probably one of the tougher schools out there. Apparently, you know, it's a big universe. But it's the only thing, I mean, it's a logical extension of what the near-death experience is really all about.
Right.
Wow. So you very kindly gave me a link to download your ebook, My Very Own Psychedelic Psychotherapy. And I've been reading a little bit of that just about every evening, and I'm almost through. And as I said earlier, I'm an old guy from a very conservative background. And when I read what you put yourself through, both in the desert, the maze, and then in the Amazon, and drinking this potent stuff, why would you put yourself through all that? That to me, it would sound like torture and torment. Why do it? Why do it?
Well, interestingly, when I was first reading about the near-death experience, and I read the Tibetan Book of the Dead, there was another book. It was Tibetan Book of the Living and Dying, and that was written by Timothy Leary and Richard Alpert, who became Ram Dass, and Ralph Metzner. And what it was they took the Tibetan Book of the Dead and rewrote it basically. About a psychedelic experience. They were working with LSD and psilocybin mushrooms and these types of things. And so it kind of dovetailed into my interest in death, ego death, experiencing real death, which I did experience in one of my ayahuasca ceremonies. I mean, flat out dying and losing my mind all in the same night. It was really scary, but my feeling was I had a fear. I had an inability to let ego death, to let go of that part of me, and so that's one thing I was interested in. And I had a major fear of actually death, and I think it's possible, probably because the way I grew up in a pretty kind of a psychological, physical war zone. And when you're very, very young like that, you know, you can, you know, really develop a serious fear of death, which I always had. And so, you know, I could do so much work in studying religion and doing these types of things, going to the desert. You know, I was doing my 40 days and 40 nights in the desert, and I almost
Almost
literally
killed yourself.
And in fact, I'm feeling some of the effects of it as we speak. I have one of my ner a
Yeah.
nerve damage, and it freaks out every once in a while, and this last week it's freaked out. But I felt like one of the people that really, really influenced me was Terence McKenna. I'm not sure if you've heard of him, but he really reintroduced psychedelics back into the culture, because Timothy Leary and the whole 60s movement, he kind of took the whole thing over a cliff a little bit,
Yeah.
because he turned it into, they were doing some really responsible studies and work with these things, but it became like a party drug. And
Yeah.
at that time, and you have the Vietnam War going on, and then all the
Right.
protests and the whole, so they made them Schedule I drugs, which is, no practical, useful purpose, which we're now finding is absolutely preposterous because of how much good it's they're starting to see
Right.
using psychedelics, and most of it because of veterans that came
Yeah.
back from Iraq and PTSD. And once you start curing the veterans, you can't say no to everybody else. So that's why you're starting to see it roll, all these things
Okay.
rolling out around the country. But anyway, Terrence McKenna once said that taking some of these psychedelics, you can kind of have a religious experience on demand. And some people say it's a cop out, and my feeling is you don't do these things to have fun, and they're scary to me. They're very, very scary to sit down in a Moloka, in the Amazon, and you're going to be doing this. You're Once you take the ayahuasca, you're there for about 6 hours, and it can go any way. You don't know which way it's going to go. But I felt like it was going to give me the ability to, really see who I was, really face my deepest, darkest fears, which I had been going through a lot of them. And one of them, the ceremony I had was before my son passed. And then after my son passed, I was really, really, really stuck in this cycle of like grief, regret, all these kind of things, really not being able to kind of move forward at all. And so, and that's another reason I went the second time, because I really wanted to see if I could, blow through some of this. And that was the scariest thing, is doing that, having all of this stuff I was dealing with, feeling like, am I even going to come back from it? And it really did change my life. It changed it in the first time I did it. It really, moved the needle. But this last time I did it, in terms of trying to pull myself out of this disaster I was living in, it really had a huge effect on me. So I think if you do these things for the right reason, if you do them really responsibly, if you understand how important set and setting is, if you're going to the right kind of place, particularly in Peru, and you're sitting with shaman, like real deal shaman, not, then I think you can have a transformative experience.
Okay, interesting. So foreign to my knowledge that I'm finding it very, very interesting. Finding your book very interesting as well. Back to you, Kathleen.
Are you familiar, by the way, with the work of Graham Hancock?
Oh I love listening to him. He, in fact, he did a he. If you have a chance and haven't already seen it, he did a TED Talk. It's about 20 minutes long, and he talks about why psychedelics are so important. And that talk just blew me away, because he's such an amazing orator, and he just goes with nothing. It's just And it just wells up out of him,
Well,
and it's
he was
very.
downloaded the book Entangled during ayahuasca. So he wrote, Peter, he wrote a book called Entangled, and it was just wow. This book, he says, was just downloaded during ayahuasca. But what I was going to say, DJ, I've also experienced ayahuasca in the jungles of Peru. I've gone about 10 times, and the more that you do it, the more it goes. It's like peeling the onion, they say. So you kind of keep going, and gets more profound. And I would say, during my experience with ayahuasca, it was, I saw myself as a native woman. I mean, from ancient times, I could see the reflection in the river, and I could see myself, but a different person altogether. I would say my experience with ayahuasca was profound, but coming back home, back to the reality of what is my life, I can't say that it was as transformational or transformative as what you describe. And I just wonder why that is.
I think part of it, I was in such bad shape when I went there. That, and I was hitting this topic head on. I mean, that's, this last time I went was to the Sacred Valley. And basically every single night there was, I did, I think, eight ceremonies. And on this trip, I also did Bufo, which is a toad, which is even like another degree more powerful than ayahuasca. It's shorter acting. That was the scariest thing by far I ever did in my life. But I really, so much of what changes people, I think, in these ceremonies is that you're literally, it's like you're rewiring your brain a little bit. And we have the ability to, through neuroplasticity, where you can kind of rewire. And when you're, especially when you're very young, depending on how you grew up, you could really, these wires could be all tangled up, samskaras, they call them in Hinduism. And when I'm in the ceremony, I never lay down like a lot of people lay down, and then they close their eyes and they see everything. And I never did that. I didn't have that kind of experience. I was always either seated upright, cross-legged, or
Yeah,
in
that's what
full
they
lotus.
recommended.
So I was always that, or in lotus position. And I would say a lot of the time I spent doing yoga, which I actually healed my back, which had been disastrous for about 10 years, completely healed it in one night, and it's never been a problem. But I basically, I'm just there working and working and working and rewiring. I mean, literally doing certain things with my eyes, this, what's that called? I forget. It's something that you can do with your eyes that tends to like recalibrate certain things in your. So that, I do a lot of that, and I think one of the things that I did when I was there, the first time I was there, I was running a little hedge fund when I was down in the Amazon. Again, that's my background is finance, and I had this vision that I should close my fund when I was in the jungle, and I didn't do it, and I always regretted it. And so this time when I went, I had that same experience, and I knew this time. And so while I was there, before I got home, I drafted a letter and I sent it, and I closed my business before I left. And so it kind of, it's when you come back, you can very easily kind of, this is, there's just so much noise here. That's one of the other really important things, which I have, which I'm just fortunate, is my wife does. She's a psychotherapist and she does psychedelic integration. So there are not a lot of people in the country that do it. And so she has like a waiting list like a mile long of people that want this, because when you come back, it's almost like you need to decompress, and so many things open up. And if you have somebody that can help you unpackage a lot of this stuff, I think it can have longer lasting impact. So my recommendation is anybody that would go there is to have somebody like that already set up so that when they come back, they go right into it.
And to make sure that you're going to a very reputable facility, because there's a lot of what they call brujos that are, so it's very, very important to make sure that,
Really important.
because, okay, we need to carry on then, Peter.
We're running out of time, and there's so
Yes,
much here we want to hear.
I
So
know.
I'm going to switch gears a little bit, if I may, DJ. You've done a lot of work on socioeconomic issues, race relations, spirituality. And my observation as a 70-year-old is that in my lifetime, we're seeing increased problems of poverty in many areas. We're seeing loss of freedom in the Western world, and we're seeing more difficulties in interpersonal relationships. So why should that be, with all this enlightenment, from your perspective? Why do we appear to be going downhill in so many areas?
wow, I have I could go on that about the next few days. It's so complex. I mean you have an economic standpoint, you have a spiritual standpoint, an interpersonal standpoint. I mean, I don't know where you'd want to start with that. I mean, if we talk about economics, which is,
Sure, let's look at that.
Well, I mean, we basically, we've hollowed out the middle class.
Yes.
And so, without that, which drives, it's the engine of our economy, people are falling further and further behind. It's so much more difficult to keep a family together. You're competing mm-hmm. with so much noise. Mostly you don't have even both parents at home oftentimes, so the kids are, there's so much noise. We've had a breakdown, in community doesn't exist. Back in the day, I used to live in a neighborhood, I came from a crazy family, and there were enough of those crazy families, but we would go outside and we would play all day and mm-hmm. into the night. And, when I had kids, and I'm in a, not far from where I grew up, and it's, in the suburbs, and you couldn't just have, kids over. It had to be a play date. And, mm-hmm. you had to get the parents' permission for them to go across the street to play on the playground, like literally. And so, people are fearful of so much. Mm-hmm. There's actually, they say, less crime now than there used to be, but the reporting yeah. is so far off the charts that people are just afraid, and they're afraid of everything, In politics, we're so polarized now. There's so much anger. Then you have something like COVID come along, and it's just, there's just so much anger, and there's confusion, and it stems from, from fear. And a lot of mm-hmm. that is channeled through greed. And so, but if you want to look at it from a purely economic standpoint, the middle class has been hollowed out. I think so much of it has to do with, and people might say, well, you're a conspiracy theorist, but I can tell you from being in the business for 35 years mm-hmm. that you have these central banks that are just printing mm-hmm. money.
Absolutely.
And we've seen
nothing.
literally, it used to be paper. Now it's digits.
Yeah.
We're now at $30 trillion in debt. And, the currency just keeps getting debased. We don't totally see it because we don't say, well, the dollar's going down, but we measure the dollar against other currencies and other countries that are in worse shape than we are. But you just see this constant erosion, people getting further and further into debt. The top 1%. We're really at extremes that we only saw back in the Great Depression.
Yep.
So in my opinion, this thing's going to blow. Yep. It would have mm-hmm. blown already. I mean, if the government hadn't pumped so much money in after COVID, this thing would have gone up in flames.
Mm.
I think we're on borrowed time right now. I think that's pretty clear. And
I would agree.
So the bad news is that, that I think we're, the business cycle hasn't been eliminated. Stock markets aren't supposed to go straight up like this for, 15, 20 years. And you don't have this kind of disparity. So I think we're due for some major, economic convulsions. That's the bad news. The good news is that, oftentimes it takes, a major, catastrophe like the Great Depression before things really start to turn.
Right.
And when you look at the other side of the Great Depression, how much came out, the social safety net with Social Security and all these other programs that, that really changed things. And I think, the good news is that on the other side of this, it wakes people up. People, they start to look at what's really been going on, because now they're just like, hey, man, when COVID hit, it was a matter of weeks before we had, people lining up for food, miles long. It's like, how the hell does that happen? Mm-hmm. The average person has $500 in their bank account, literally.
Yeah.
They're one issue. So the market doesn't have, the economy doesn't have to go down for too long for this thing to really blow quickly. And then people are going to say, what the hell has been going on? And when they really look at what's going on, then there's going to be some trouble.
There's a lot of angry people.
I agree with you. Yeah. I agree with you. Yeah. And I lived in Zimbabwe before I came to Canada and lived through hyperinflation, the worst the world's ever seen, measured in millions of percent. And I've seen the pain that causes, believe me. Anyway, we're sort of running down time. Kathleen, back to you.
Yes, thank you. Oh, DJ, I must ask you this because I was watching a program a few years ago now on Gaia, and I think it was Regina Meredith was the host of this particular episode, and she was saying to her guest how people just naturally assume that when they die, and I might upset some people by even saying this, but most people think that when they die or when their loved ones have passed on, it's very comforting for them to think that they've gone on to a better place. And we want to believe that. And so my question is, in these near-death experiences, have anybody ever recounted seeing hell instead of heaven?
yes. Again, the ones that I came across, these things resolved, meaning they did experience that, they were there. But they came out of it and then moved forward with the near-death experience. There are a handful where I heard people didn't come back, and it was very disturbing. And they didn't I don't want to say they didn't recover from that, but it really had a pretty negative lasting impact on them. So it's not common. But it does happen, and that's tough. I can't imagine having that happen, and not having that resolve, because where do you go from there? You experience what you experience, and nobody can tell you different.
Are
But
these people, would you say, sketchy people in or have done terrible things in their life to cause this to happen?
I didn't get that impression, but I
Really?
mean, oftentimes it's people that are, maybe not in the best psychological frame of mind. And if you get into, it's like example, if you go to do an ayahuasca ceremony, there's some people that just shouldn't be in there. They're just they're not they don't have the, psychological makeup to withstand some of the things you get hit with or process it in any way. And I think that, especially for somebody who has a tremendous amount of fear, like just kind of built into their bones, that you would expect that, if things get dicey early on in something like that, it would be hard to pull out from or see it through. That's what I get, because I've also heard where people have had that experience, but they didn't live a horrible life, but I do also believe in the kind of the yin yang thing, and there isn't a heaven without a hell, and I experienced that no question in ayahuasca. I mean, I knew that I was, if I was going to have like an amazing experience, that I really needed to have a really difficult experience too. It's part of the whole process. You kind of can't have one without the other. That's my belief system.
So what did they see when they saw something not pleasant? What was it exactly about the experience that in their minds was just was hell? What was it?
Well, in one of them, it was they saw like almost like creatures, like
Oh,
evil
really?
creatures or the devil or something like this. You tended to get this sense that they went down physically, they went down into something. Whereas normally you get this feeling that people are going up, out of body, up into the tunnel and then moving on. Where with these people, you get a sense that they either immediately or within a very short period of time, maybe from the tunnel, started to move down. I mean, it could be metaphor, but they were moving down. It was tended to be dark. They heard bad sounds. There were smells that they had that were disturbing, and they would either see or hear like evil entities. But again, the one that was the most detailed, the person was very, very religious, and so I think that again, that there can be it can be the way that we create this these metaphors, like how do we understand what we're hearing or feeling, and so that they may be kind of, I don't want to say creating, but this is how they experienced it, you know, kind of visually, because these near-death experiences are extremely visual.
So when you say resolve, do you mean resolve while they're in that state of near death, or?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. During the near-death experience, like one of them, like basically he called out to, you know, God help me, and you know, these kind of things. And then he felt this energy come and just lift him out of there. And he had this feeling that he had been literally pulled out of hell. And so that's what kind of what you'll hear. Where when I say resolve, I mean that they moved through and into a full near, you know, more of a near-death experience that's much, you know, is a very, very positive experience.
Right.
Interesting. So we're nearly at the end of our time. We're way past the end of our time, but this is so good. We got to keep going.
Yeah.
We like to ask our expert guests like yourself a question for our audience. Given that many of our audience will be seeing what you're seeing, the hollowing out of the middle class, facing rising debt, facing a very uncertain future, what's one tip that you would give them that they could start doing today to make their future look a bit brighter?
From a financial standpoint, would you say?
Whatever you feel is important that would help people.
You know, I think that being in the West and how attached we are to things, and how much pressure we're under as a society, there's two things I would do that I think are more practical in nature. One is I would try to stay out of debt. Mm-hmm. I would have as little debt as possible, which from a financial standpoint over the long term can do so much for you financially, but also not this feeling you have this gun to your head. You know, when I started my business initially, it was all commission based as a stockbroker, and, you know, having to come into work every month I don't know what my income is, and I got a mortgage, and now I've got a kid, and I've experienced, you know, both extremes in that business. Mm-hmm. But what I will say is that just not having debt, and part of that is not owning a lot of things, and just obviously to learn to be less attached to things. So I would say those go hand in hand, you know, the whole debt thing and just not getting sucked into this, I got to own this or I got to own that. And I would say the other thing would be, and I've actually been fairly good at this, is just stay away from as much as possible, you know, social media, you know, the whole TikTok, you know, Facebook, you know. I have a YouTube channel, but I've never had Facebook or TikTok or I may have nothing. And I'm a very tech savvy person and I'm doing a lot of different things. But what I've learned is for someone like me, I would just disappear in these things. And I see what it's doing to people. And I see all these kids. You know, you go to a restaurant and you got a table with, you know, five kids and they're all on their phones. And, you know, and then you got the parent over here. It's like, to me, it's really, really sad.
It is.
You know, and seeing everybody doing the selfies and, you know, how many followers do I have? And it's, you know, and anyway, those would be my two things.
Wonderful.
That would be it.
Great. Thank you for that. And I don't want to go into my story, but I agree with you 100% on things, on not having too many things. But that's for another show. Thanks very much, DJ. Back to you, Kathleen.
So DJ, how do people contact you? And just tell us a little bit about your book, Roomy for Kids.
Well, if you want to reach me, probably easiest through my website, and depending on your interest, the one that's really based on the near-death experience, it's called NDE Central. You can reach me through that, but you'll also find some amazing research on the site, links to all research papers and things like that, as well as really, really great videos, documentaries, all on the near-death experience. So you can either go to that or my other site, which is more geared towards my film and my books, is called Project Shift. So it's www.project-shift.com.
Okay.
And they're both connected to each other. So if you go to the Project Shift, that's probably the easiest way to reach me. And then, but you can also shoot over to the other website, NDE Central. And Roomie for Kids is, I'd never written before anything before. And I'm massively dyslexic, so I don't even read. But because of the world I was in, you know, when my son passed and I had all, you know, weeks and months, and I didn't want to say years, but, you know, spending a lot of time just as a recluse, I just started writing. And so this is my third book in 3 years. I'll never write another one.
Ah.
I can't believe I wrote one. But anyway, this book, Roomie for Kids, is I did a film series on poetry, and a lot of the I turned 21 poems into a short film each, and a lot of them were Roomie poetry. So I really kind of disappeared into poetry for a while. But his in particular, and I worked with Coleman Barks, who translated his poetry, and Robert Bly. They were in some of my films. And I thought, what's a good antidote for social media? And to me, you know, learn story, which we've lost, and poetry, and learning to understand metaphor. And if you can get kids, and you can do that through images. And so the book is filled with, I think, beautiful illustrations, one for each poem. And then at the back of the book, there's kind of a workbook section kind of thing. So this would be read with a parent. And after you read the poem and you experience the illustration, if the parent wants, in the back there's an interpretation of the poem. Every poem has more than one interpretation, so it's I call a possibility, but it's something that you can describe, talk to the child with, and the child, trust me, could be 6 to 60, or I'm sorry, not 60 to 100, because Rumi's poems, you know, a great metaphor means so many things to so many
Sure.
different people.
Right.
And then along with the description of the poem, there's three questions that you can ask the child to really get them to think. And so the book is kind of like, you
Right.
know, here's a potential antidote to all the social media and to kind of looking at things that are a lot more, the really real, I would say.
Fantastic. Wow.
Excellent.
Yep.
Thank you very much. Good. Well, for me, thanks for being on our show, DJ, and thanks to our audience for listening. And to make sure you don't miss out on these wonderful guests we're bringing you, hop onto our website, theyakkingshow.com, and hit the purple button at the top or the bottom, and you'll get on our list. Send you one email a week telling you who's coming on the show this week and who's coming next week. So once again, thanks everyone. Bye-bye. Over to you, Kathleen.
Hello. Well, thank you again for tuning into our show today. We so appreciated having you. And DJ, I really do hope that we have you back on the show because I think we can go on for another hour on
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah,
this topic.
absolutely.
Oh, it was
Anytime, we have a
absolutely.
lot in common. So, somebody who has done ayahuasca on one side, and well, did you? No, you did the
I
ayahuasca,
did,
and
yes.
I'm getting all, but I'm yeah. So, but thank you for having me. I really do appreciate it. I
All
enjoyed the
right.
conversation.
And if anyone is interested in being a guest on our show, we invite you to visit us at theyakkingshow.com. All you need to do is click on the Contacts tab where you will find a short application form, and we would love to hear from you. So until next time, take care, everyone. Bye-bye.
Bye.